Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, like the rest of the Pacific Northwest, is reeling from the heat. That's at least partly why, mask or no mask, we've been slowly venturing back into the AC-equipped local theaters. We made two treks into theatrical cool this past week, once to see the music documentary Summer of Soul, which carries the tagline, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, and once to see the based-on-Twitter curiosity Zola. For our third film, we stayed home and checked on the latest Steven Soderbergh effort, No Sudden Move on HBO Max. Let's begin this week's show by turning the clock back to the summer of 1969. That's when, as everybody remembers, the so-called 3 days of peace and music festival called Woodstock attracted the nearly 500,000 fans to upstate New York. Who, though, remembers the Harlem Cultural Festival, an event that was held on Sunday afternoons over a period of 6 weeks that same summer in Harlem's Mount Morris Park, now Marcus Garvey Park? After all, it attracted upward of 300,000 attendees to see, free of charge, musical acts such as Stevie Wonder, Sly and the Family Stone, Nina Simone, Mahalia Jackson, the Staple Singers, Gladys Knight and the Pips, not to mention Latin stars such as Ray Barreto and Mango Santamaria. Based on footage shot by the late Hal Tolchin, a veteran television producer, that festival is now the highlight of a documentary film titled Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. Winner both of the Grand Jury Prize and the Audience Award at this year's Sundance Film Festival, Summer of Soul was directed by Amir Questlove Thompson, known to most people as the leader of the in-house Tonight Show band. And it is far more than just a concert film. It is, simply enough, a chapter of American cultural history that only now is being recognized.
Yeah, I love this movie. I've seen it twice. I actually saw it when it premiered at Sundance. Of course, it was virtual this year, so I saw it at home. And I knew that if it ever got released in a theater, I would have to see it on a big screen. So I went back and saw it a second time. And that's where you really should see it. It is on Hulu right now. So if you're not able to make it out to a theater, you should see it regardless. But if you can see it on a big screen, see it that way, because the concert footage in this documentary is some of the best concert footage I've seen in any documentary. And it's insane to me that this just sat there for 50 years in practically pristine condition and nobody did anything with it. And thank God that Questlove came around. And of course, he's a musician himself, as you mentioned. He's a member of The Roots going back several decades now. And so I think he understands music in a way that a lot of us probably wouldn't if we were given this footage. So I'm glad somebody got a hold of it that knew what to do with it. And I want to mention a couple of individual performances that really stuck with me. One artist or act that you didn't mention, Dan, is The Fifth Dimension, who, of course, is best known for Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In, and what's the one about the hot air balloon, Up, Up and Away.
Yeah.
And they seem like an unusual choice for this festival because, and they talk about it in the documentary, that they were definitely more of a pop act and were played on white radio stations as well as black radio stations, but they were kind of pigeonholed in one or the other, or they were too in between for too many people. And watching them perform live, I'd never seen them perform live before. I'd never seen footage of them. They're incredible on stage.
No.
And the way that they move around their microphones, the way they harmonize, they bring in this gospel inflection. It was really incredible. And then watching some of the surviving members looking at this footage that they've never seen before.
Marilyn McCoo, yeah.
Yeah, is really moving. And of course, there's gospel influences going throughout a lot of the artists in Summer of Soul. And another performance I want to flag up is the one between Mahalia Jackson and a very young Mavis Staples, who perform Martin Luther King's favorite song. And that moment is, it's kind of dead center in the middle of this movie. And it really brings the house down. And it's amazing to think that Mahalia Jackson was apparently sick that day, and that's why she brought Mavis Staples in to back her up. And if that's Mahalia Jackson on a bad day, imagine her on a good one, because she just puts it all out there. It's really one of the most stunning musical moments that I can recall in any movie.
Yeah, I think we need to point out that if people are going to go see Summer of Soul thinking they're going to see Woodstock 2 or the Black Woodstock, which is how they tried to sell this film after it was shot, you're going to be disappointed. I appreciate everything you had to say, Nathan, but I don't think there's enough music in this film. I mean, they had to cut it down, and what they had to do, or what they decided to do, was make it a combination look at Black history and look at the struggle and mix it up with the music from this particular festival. And I think that makes it an extremely important document in so many ways. But I wanted more music. I want to see the second cut in which we see all of Sly and the Family Stone, in which we see all of the Latin Kings, in which we see more of Stevie Wonder on drums. Can you believe Stevie? There's a whole section in which it's just the blind young boy that he was just pounding away on drums.
Yes, I can. I can believe it because Stevie can do anything. That's why I want to say this is a music documentary and not a concert film. It is
right.
not like
correct.
It is
correct.
Not like the recent Aretha Franklin documentary, Amazing Grace, which was pretty much just
yes.
her performing. This is also, there's a lot of historical context going on, and I appreciated that. I mean, would I want more music? I always want more Sly and the Family Stone, but you get basically two full songs. I don't know how much more he could put in without just making it a straight-up concert.
Well, I thought it was, the only real criticism I had was the fact that they broke up Stevie Wonder's performance, and I think that the other thing that happens in this film is there's a great sort of historical context on the one hand, but on the other hand, like setting the stage for how this festival came about, and we know it was largely Tony Lawrence and his influence and impact, so I think that's good. But the fact that they decided to have it over the course of 6 weekends, because the one thing that strikes you in comparison to Woodstock, the people who are attending this festival, and I kept wondering, what's Mount Morris Park? And then I realized it's Marcus Garvey Park now. So that's what I was like, what? Where's this? But it took place over the course of 6 weekends or 6 Sundays, because all these people are standing the entire time and they're packed, you know, like shoulder to shoulder.
There's like 50,000 people
right, or something. Everyone's ecstatic and there's not like water and bathroom issues. And you know, so yeah. I found that to be an intriguing aspect of this, that maybe they could have said, oh, why did we decide to do it this way? Or what, you know, they had to get the permits. We see some of the crowd shots, which I really liked because people were so excited and so enthused.
Yeah, at one point, there's a guy in the tree.
Yeah. Well, and I also must say that for the first time, I think I had a much fuller appreciation for the role that church and gospel music played in the lives of people, especially during a period of enslavement and, you know, coming forward. This was an opportunity for freedom. This was an opportunity. And I'm not sure I ever appreciated that before, because I've always thought, well, why would you gravitate toward this white Jesus whatever? And so this did a great job of showcasing that. I agree with you, Dan, that I would have been happier had there been not less history, but maybe there had been more music. And how you accomplish that in a short documentary or shorter documentary rather than a series, doesn't this cry out to be a multi-part series potentially?
It's a multi-part festival.
Maybe. I mean, I think with Summer of Soul, though, what you're discounting maybe is that maybe we do need that historical context, because so few people know what this event even is or knew that it happened outside of the 50,000 plus people that actually attended it back in 1969. And they do talk about, I think one of my favorite stretches of the movie is they talk about how the moon landing happened on one of the days that the festival was going on. I think it was the last weekend that it was happening. And they show all of these contemporary news interviews, including a Man on the Street interview by Red Fox, of all people. They managed to get his opinions on this, talking about, well, yeah, it's all well and good that we've got a man on the moon, but what about all of the people down here that, what they say, there's nothing on the moon. And
July 20th, 1969.
I'm thinking about the Gil Scott-Heron song about it. And so I thought that does a good job in sort of a montage format, kind of showing how the world outside was creeping into this
enclosed environment. Okay, let me tell you what I didn't like about it.
Okay.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, why? Chris Rock, why? I mean, I don't
probably because they're friends with Questlove. That's my
maybe. No, seriously, because that really didn't add anything to my way of thinking to this. But yeah,
but that's like 30 seconds of a 2-hour movie. That's mostly thrilling.
You know,
what do you think?
One of the questions around this movie was, you know, well, would it have made a difference had it come out at the time? And of course, we could go into why it didn't come out at the time. I mean, I think there are a whole lot of reasons for that the movie doesn't really address.
Yeah.
But if it had come out at at the time, it might have been just another, hey, another music documentary. Here it comes out 50 years later, and yes, maybe it would have made a difference then, but it is now is the time for this. These are issues that are coming up today, and so I think that the timing right now, it was supposed to come out on the 50th anniversary, but because of the pandemic, it didn't. But it is an important cultural document for today.
And I think that if it had come out back in 1970 or 1971, it probably would have had even less music than it has now. Think about, I mean, of course, the original Woodstock, the Michael Wadley film is, you know, it's a gargantuan movie. It's 3 hours
right.
long. But think about, you know, D.A. Pennebaker's Monterey Pop film.
Yeah.
I mean, that's only, what, like 70 minutes long?
Mm-hmm.
And so much of the stuff that got cut out is even better than the stuff they decided to include. So I think the form that it's in now might be the ideal form, although you may not agree. I think this is a terrific movie. This
is like top 10 end of the year list. No, it is a terrific movie.
Potential.
There's, you know, I think that maybe we were just being a little bit too critical about things that struck us. But yeah, people definitely need to see this.
Yes.
And Nathan, you're right. See it on the big screen.
Yeah. And that was Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Zola and the HBO Max offering No Sudden Move. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss Summer of Soul. Let's now move to Zola and No Sudden Move. Let's begin with a movie that is pure 21st century, it being based on nothing less than a series of, yes, tweets. Movies derive from a range of sources, from books and plays to memoirs and outright imagination. Zola, which actually should be pronounced at Zola, is a feature film based on, believe it or not, a Twitter feed. It was in 2015 that a 20-year-old server at a Detroit Hooters named Azia Zola Wells published a 148-tweet tome about an experience she'd had on a trek to Florida, in which she had witnessed exotic dancing, prostitution, an attempted suicide, an attempted armed robbery, a shooting, and if you can believe it, more. I add that qualifier because others involved have questioned some of what happened. Still, both Rolling Stone magazine and the Washington Post have confirmed most of the events, though movie makers have never been bothered much with veracity. Thus, we have Zola, directed by Janixa Bravo and co-written by Jeremy O. Harris, all based on Wells' tweets and starring Taylor Page as the title character and Riley Keough as Stephanie, the woman who Wells claims lured her into the situation that Rolling Stone said reads like Spring Breakers meets Pulp Fiction as told by Mickey Minaj.
First of all, I have to comment on the critique that maybe this was not all true. Well, who cares? Because it's not Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know. So, I mean, we're not looking at this at the history of anything. And I give a lot of credit to anyone's trying to make anything out of a bunch of tweets. I mean, honestly. And I think that trying to transfer those tweets, which were intriguing, almost like a serial that people used to look at or listen to every week, I think the rollout would have been even more intriguing. And so that's one of the problems transferring this to the screen. But I thought the performances, especially by Taylor Page, were really, really impressive. Riley Keough, the fact that they never comment on her being this white girl who is trying to affect all of these, what she believes would be appropriate manifestations of somebody who was African-American, you know, that sort of goes unaddressed.
Although
however,
you see it
Taylor
in her face.
Yeah. is sort of her Zola her is sort
Zola's
of like
face,
what?
Yeah. Yeah,
uh-huh. I mean, she's horrified by some of the things that happen. And then Nicholas Braun, who people may recognize as Cousin Greg from Succession, he needs to be a little careful because this is just in some respects a replay of his doofus character.
He's playing Cousin Greg again.
Yeah,
in
from
this
that
movie,
TV
yeah.
show. And then finally we have Colman Domingo, who was alternately terrifying and charismatic. And so he is the supposed manager of these girls who are going to Florida to do these things. So I don't care if any of this stuff actually happened. I do think that, like I said, the translation from tweet to screen is a little bit rough and it doesn't always work. But sometimes it really does. And I think that that's due to the performances, most notably of Taylor Page. And part of the difficulty here is this is a commentary about trafficking and the way that it happens more frequently than we might recognize. And the role that someone who's in this position, I mean, Zola does manage to set some boundaries, intriguingly enough, maybe because she has figured out how to make more money out of this whole process, which is an interesting entrepreneurial feature to what's happening. So this is not a movie for everyone.
Yeah.
I think that would be fair to say. I do think that it comments on exploitation and trafficking and so forth. It tries to play it a little too cutesy at different points, and that's why it doesn't ultimately work in its entirety.
Yeah, well, I mean, Janice Bravo as a filmmaker is trying a lot of things. There are a lot of sort of playful stylistic devices going on here. I really liked the way that in Zola, you really feel the omnipotence of cell phones, the fact that the timestamps we see on the screen look like lock screens on phones, all of the notification sounds she gets start worming their way into the musical score and even overtake the dialogue at certain points where the phone is going off so much that you can't even hear it, drowns out what everybody is saying. And so I liked all of that. I think the inherent problem with this movie, I mean, and the source material, is that it just doesn't have a third act. I mean, the first act, I was really with this movie, and I was liking the way that she was telling the story. It has this dreamy kind of quality that you might see in a Sofia Coppola movie, but it also has this kind of manic, almost mm-hmm. hallucinatory quality that you'd see in like a Sean Baker film or a Harmony Korine film.
Yeah. Or think of American Honey.
Yeah, I thought of that too, which Riley Keough played a very similar role in as well. And I was really with it. And then the movie just kind of stops. I agree with you, Mary Pat, that it does make a point. But I think it kind of stops short of making a narrative point where I wanted to know, well, and so what happens with these characters now? Maybe that's part of the point that they're trying to make. But I was left a little unsatisfied at the end, despite the fact that I liked the way it was made and I liked the performances.
Yeah. And that was Zola. Let's close with No Sudden Move. Some movie directors have a recognizable style. Others stick with the same kinds of storylines. Steven Soderbergh has several different kinds of styles that he applies to a whole range of cinematic themes, from intimate portrayals such as Sex Lives and Videotape to strange conceits as Schizopolis, big-budget blockbusters such as the Ocean series to Oscar-winning crime offerings such as Traffic, sci-fi efforts such as his Solaris adaptation to neo-noir such as The Limey and Out of Sight. Soderbergh is hard to pin down. But at least in terms of those last two, his latest effort, the HBO Max film No Sudden Move, has more than a bit of similarity. A cast that includes Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, Ray Liotta, Brendan Fraser, John Hamm, Julie Fox, and Amy Simons comes together to work out the complicated plot of a 1954-era storyline that uses, as a MacGuffin, what would in reality become an important auto industry tool. No Sudden Move gives us lies, betrayals, and old grievances all pitted against the occasional, sometimes predictable sudden death. All told, it may not add up to much, but the acting is first rate, and Soderbergh, as is typical, keeps things moving at just the right pace to pique our interest, for some of us at least.
Well, here's another movie that really hooked me in its first 45 minutes or so, and then kind of slowly loosened its grip as it got more and more complicated and more characters came in, and I had a harder time figuring out who was doing what to whom and why. And I do just kind of naturally gravitate towards movies like this, and I think Soderbergh does too. I mean, like you said, he's kind of all over the place in terms of what kinds of movies he's making, but I think he feels, and I mean, you can sense it in his movies, I think he feels most at home in the noir crime genre. And this feels like some kind of B picture that Columbia would have made, you know, right, in the 1950s. It's kind of scrappy and hard and really cynical in a way that I found kind of weirdly refreshing, because the movie kind of, I mean, basically the takeaway here is there's no point to anything and, you know, everyone's just going to end up dead. But it does kind of weirdly have a sense of morals, because I don't want to give anything away, but the character who plays by the rules and does what he says he's going to do is the one that ends up walking away with his life at the end. And so I found that interesting. So yeah, you're right. This is a genre exercise. We've seen better from Soderbergh, but I liked this. I was mostly entertained by it, even if I could not pass a test on everything that happens and what Bill Duke was doing to Ray Liotta and what Ray Liotta was doing to Benicio del Toro. I don't know.
The set design was amazing.
That
I
too.
Mean, it really captured that sort of period in the early 50s. So it's post-war, but yet at the same time, modernism had not really taken hold yet. And people are sort of stuck in these gender roles and these other roles.
And that house that feels so suffocating, even though it's beautifully designed.
Right, exactly.
With bad wallpaper.
Yeah, really. The bad wallpaper was replete throughout. But yeah, there was something just missing somehow here. And I can't – it wasn't linear. Let's be clear about that. But it was almost a little formulaic in a weird way. And I wanted to like someone besides the kid.
I liked Don Cheadle.
Yeah. I think that's what's intriguing. We start out not knowing who's who and what's what. And so our allegiances and alliances sort of shift throughout this. And there's also, we should say, a surprise performer who shows up at one point, and we won't say who it is because I think that's better.
But he has an extended monologue about, you know, power and whatever, that it's like, oh, really?
It's
it's a little insufferable.
Patty Chayefsky.
Yes,
also,
exactly.
It's interesting.
Or Aaron Sorkin.
This was written by Ed Solomon, who co-created Bill and Ted
the
and
Bill
the Men
and
in
Ted,
Black movies.
Right.
Because
so.
It's definitely not funny.
No.
It's
no,
not
no.
Funny
oh, God, no. There's
it
not
is,
a laugh at all.
I don't know. I think it has some dark humor.
It goes, see, but that's just it. If it had gone a little bit more that way, or if
like
it
more
given
out of
us
sight
somebody,
in a way.
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Out of
exactly.
Sight, which was a terrific film. Well, I think I'm really with both of you when I think that this is middling Soderbergh, and I think the good thing about it is
it's still Soderbergh.
It's performances, and he manages to pull you through things. So it never bored me. I was never bored with No Sudden Move. And that's the end of our discussion about that film. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Murray Pat Truthart and I discussed Summer of Soul and Zola. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the great Smokey Robinson. The Beatles were huge. And the first thing they said when you interviewed them, oh yeah, we grew up on Motown. They were the first white act to admit they grew up listening to black music. And you're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.